Hello again, I'm Armin Alney. Today we're talking about the latest government shutdown. It is over, at least for the moment, and we're not talking about the blame game. We want to go deeper into the history of American government shutdowns back to 1981, how the White House and Congress can get away with a practice that would lead to new elections in other countries. Let me just begin with a cartoon that I have pasted on my refrigerator door. It's Non Sequitur by Wiley Miller, and it shows people carrying a sign, and the sign says, "Government for the people who hate government, by the people who hate to govern." Norm Ornstein, let me introduce you first, resident congressional scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, author of yet another book, One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Desperate, the Disillusioned, and the Not Yet Deported. Great to have you on our program.
It's always great to be with you, Warren.
So what about the idea that we have government for people who don't like government by people who hate to govern?
I'm afraid there's an awful lot of truth to that. And what we've seen over the period from the late 1970s, really up through the present moment, is multiple times when those who wanted to spend less confronted those who had a different set of priorities, and with a very different process for dealing with budgets and government spending than almost any other country, where we do for most of government, everything except automatic programs like Social Security and Medicare that are on formulas, annual appropriations, 12 bills for the last number of years that have to be implemented by the start of a new fiscal year, which is October 1. And if you have these disputes and they're not resolved, you get a shutdown. And we regularly have threats of partial or larger shutdowns. And in many cases, we actually get them. And they're over different priorities. But a lot of those priorities come from people who are delighted to shut down the government and to show people how they can have freedom without it.
Let me introduce our other guest. Linda Bilmes is a Daniel Patrick Moynihan Senior Lecturer in Public Policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School. It's good to have you back on our program.
Thank you. Good to be back.
How many shutdowns have we had since 1981? I believe that was the first one.
So we've had 12 shutdowns since then, some of them longer, some shorter. During the Clinton administration, there were two back-to-back shutdowns that collectively lasted for about 27 days. And I think that it's fair to say that none of these shutdowns they've all been extremely disruptive and costly, but none of them were necessary from the perspective of trying to get the budget enacted. You know, they've all been about other kinds of things.
You say budget, and yet it's been a long time since the Congress actually passed a budget.
Well, the Congress has, in 1974, enacted a sweeping budget reform bill, which was the first time that it had passed a budget reform bill since 1921. And the purpose of the 1974, which was a post-Watergate kind of legislation, was to try and reestablish congressional control over the budget and to transfer some power from the president back to the Congress, where constitutionally Congress has the power of the purse. Unfortunately, it's very clear that this 1974 law and all of the tweaks that have happened subsequently have been true failures. The Congress has only passed all of the appropriations bills that go with the budget four times since then on time. And the country is being subjected to a constant and very kind of exhausting series of shutdowns and fiscal cliffs and debt ceiling brinksmanship and various kinds of problems, to the point that it's really difficult for anybody who is working with the federal government to know what's going to happen with the budget next year, next month, next week. There is no reliability in the system anymore.
So, Norm Ornstein, what about the constitutional provision that the power of the purse lies with the Congress, not even the Senate, just the Congress, largest of our deliberative bodies? How did the chief executive get involved in this?
Well, it's always been the case that while Congress has the power of the purse, which means that it alone can appropriate money from the federal treasury, it has to do it in the form of bills that pass the House and Senate in identical form and then are signed or can be vetoed by the president. The ultimate power is still with Congress because it can override the veto, but a president can't unilaterally take money and spend money unless Congress has appropriated it. Now, you know, Linda, in talking about the 1974 Act, a good part of the impetus was because President Nixon had, in some cases, refused to spend money that had been appropriated by and authorized by Congress, and they wanted to make sure that abuses by the president of what they saw as their primary role had been checked. But, you know, we've left intact that fundamental constitutional obligation, and then we get into these confrontations when the House and Senate can't agree or can't pass the bills, or the president in some cases has vetoed bills and Congress can't override them. That happened with Reagan a couple of times, for example.
What did Nixon refuse to spend money on?
Environmental programs, some other social programs. You know, we had technical terms, rescissions and deferrals. You know, Congress has given the president some leeway to fulfill the executive function of making sure that the laws are faithfully executed. And so that meant in some cases you could defer spending if it wasn't going to be effective or you couldn't actually operationally bring it off. Or you could decide you weren't going to spend money because a problem, for example, might have disappeared rather than forcing you to throw money down the drain. But Nixon abused that power in a fashion that Congress found deeply offensive, and that was a part of what happened. And it was called the Budget and Impoundment Control Act because he was impounding or refusing to spend those funds.
You mentioned the environment. You say he refused to spend money on that, and yet he was the founder of the Environmental Protection Agency.
Nixon was a complicated man.
There's a wonderful article about him by Meg Greenfield about how he would take positions on both sides and then make a an overall statement that somehow encompassed both sides without committing him to either one. It was an interesting strategy that he used.
I was just going to say that, you know, Linda has the Daniel Patrick Moynihan chair designation. Moynihan was the domestic policy advisor to Nixon, and one of the great ironies of our past is that Nixon proposed a guaranteed annual income. This was a Moynihan idea that would have been the most sweeping welfare reform ever seen in the United States. He actually worked with Nixon to get a health care reform that went further than the Affordable Care Act. And it was Democrats on the left that kept those things from happening. So Nixon could have gone down as the great liberal reformer if he'd gotten some cooperation from Democrats in Congress.
So, Linda Belms, you would then be celebrated for your Daniel Patrick Moynihan senior lectureship.
Well, you know, it's interesting what Norm was saying, because if it had been my turn to speak, I would have said exactly the same thing. You know, I sit in the Daniel Patrick Moynihan chair, and the politics of the guaranteed income, which was one of the sort of 20-odd books that Daniel Patrick Moynihan wrote, talks about his effort to try and provide a guaranteed minimum income for everyone in the United States, which was a sweeping, sweeping change of philosophy in terms of how we think about welfare and well-being in this country. And he persuaded Nixon of the benefits of this, and he persuaded, he almost got it. I mean, it was very close, and it derailed at the end. But he certainly was, it certainly was an era in which there were big ideas, and, you know, some of which almost happened.
Almost happened, but
almost. I mean, some did happen, but some did happen, but even then, the likelihood of getting everyone in Congress to go along with major reforms was very challenging.
Well, what about the fact that Congress itself is so divided in both parties? And Norm Ornstein, how much does that contribute to the dysfunction that we're seeing today?
We're seeing a tribalism in our politics that makes finding agreement more difficult. It's made more difficult as well by a cultural difference between the parties that we see both in Congress and in the public as a whole. Democrats, perhaps in part because they see government as being a positive force, but for other larger philosophical reasons, believe that compromise is a good thing to do. Republicans, independents, by the way, in the country agree with them. Republicans are much more inclined to want to draw the line in the dust and stand on principle, even if it means nothing gets done, including some of the things that they might support. And we've seen that play out in many ways with the confrontation that we just had, where we had Democrats with a few Republicans come up with a broad compromise on immigration, including the Dreamers, the DACA program, but as well the family reunification part that Republicans want to call chain migration, and the wall. Republicans in the end said no, the vast majority of them. We saw it in the days leading up to the shutdown again when Democrats, after the president had had his famous profane outburst, kept talking about finding a compromise here and got no response either from the White House or the other side. But there's a deeper issue here too, Warren, that has been almost lost in the discussions of the last couple of weeks, which were all about, would we have a shutdown? Who would be to blame? Would it be the Schumer shutdown? Would it be the Trump shutdown? What will happen with DACA? And now, who are the winners and who are the losers? This was about a continuing resolution because the Republicans who run the House and Senate could not pass a single one of the 12 appropriations bills before the new fiscal year began last October 1. And we have now had the fourth continuing resolution, which just punts the issue of spending priorities. And this is disagreements among Republicans to start with, that they keep it at the last year's levels. Now, this one ends on February 8th, and we still have these disagreements. You have some between the more radical members of the Republican House and Senate. In the House, they call them the Freedom Caucus, who want to cut discretionary spending, as it's called, most of the domestic programs very, very deeply. Other Republicans who want to increase defense by a pretty dramatic amount and take it out of the hide of domestic programs. And Senate Republicans who are a little bit uneasy, some of them, about making these deeper cuts. And no, they can't overcome a filibuster for those kinds of unpopular cuts in education and environmental protection, public safety, the Centers for Disease Control, and even NIH. And so we keep pushing off the deep disagreements on spending. This is about immigration. It is about the fundamental functioning of government, but it's also about a reality that not just the two parties, but the conservative wing of the Republican Party and the radical wing of the Republican Party can't agree on what government should be doing or what it ought to be spending.
You mentioned DACA, and certainly that's an important issue. What about CHIP? How did that get involved in this whole argument?
It was a bargaining chip, as we say. And one of those things that
childhood
I found...
Childhood insurance, health insurance.
Children's
program.
Health insurance program.
Yeah.
I found it, frankly, appalling. This was a program enacted in 1997. Orrin Hatch, the Republican conservative from Utah, now chair of the Finance Committee, has said for in the 10 years plus since that program was enacted, it was his proudest accomplishment. He worked with the strange bedfellow and his personal friend Ted Kennedy to enact this program. 9 million children protected with insurance who would otherwise be left without it. And its authorization ended at the end of the last fiscal year, which was September 30th of last year. It's widely popular across all the lines, but for reasons that seemed inexplicable at the time, neither the House nor Senate took it up to reauthorize it. Hatch, who's now chair of the Finance Committee and could have done it himself, got very snappish when he was asked about this, and he said the tax cuts take a higher priority, and then he went off against welfare and people who didn't deserve it, and then begrudgingly said, well, we still should have this program. But it's become clear that looking ahead, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, Paul Ryan, the Speaker, held off this program to use it for leverage, 9 million kids as hostages, to try and get the next continuing resolution. And unconscionable though it may be, it worked.
So, Linda Bilmes, back to you. We're talking here about the budget process, or allegedly we are, and yet it seems to me that the budget process really isn't about budgeting anymore.
Well, in the, you know, the budget process is something that, in the theory, is supposed to be held up as a place where ideas get reconciled and where the, it's like the commons, you know, where everybody comes together, different stakeholders come together, and there's compromise and there's deliberation and people compromise and they reconcile their different needs and aspirations. But that really hasn't happened in a long time, and there are several reasons for this. I mean, one thing that should be pointed out is that the percentage of the budget that is up for negotiation has been shrinking, because the percentage that account that is so-called mandatory spending, which means that it goes according to a formula, has gone to almost two-thirds of the budget. And it was, even in 1970, it was about one-third. So the amount of the budget that gets argued over every year is smaller and smaller as the mandatory entitlement programs eat up a larger share of the budget. But the Congress is structured in a way that most Congress people sit on either the committees that are looking at the mandatory spending or the committees that are looking at the so-called discretionary spending. And so they don't really get to make trade-offs between these things without a major change in the formula, which is very politically difficult and requires a kind of a visibility over the whole structure of the government spending, which most of Congress even is not able to see. So you have so much arguing over this small amount of spending, and then within that so-called discretionary piece, a lot of that, more than half of that, is for the military. So although it's called discretionary, it's not really discretionary because nobody is going to cut it. So the amount of pressure on each individual program is intense these days. And rather than having a real negotiation and reconciliation of ideas, it is a survival of the fittest, with huge fights breaking out among different groups who are fighting to see which of their programs is going to get maintained and hit. And the result is that the Congress is basically no longer able to do the basic job that they are supposed to do, which is to enact an annual budget in a thoughtful, deliberative way.
So back to the cartoon that I cited earlier, Government for the People Who Hate Government by the People Who Hate to Govern. Linda, is this doing more to cause people to lose trust and faith and confidence in the government than they have had in the past?
Absolutely. I would say both among those who are civil servants, who are extremely distressed by this kind of stop-go government budgeting, because for those civil servants, and I work with many many of my former students who are working in the government and extremely dedicated civil servants. I have about 40 of my former students who are working in the budget office. I have a number of my former students who are working across the Department of Interior, Department of Housing, Agriculture. And, I mean, they are faced with a situation where, first of all, every year the Congress can't pass a budget. They don't know how much money they're going to have. They don't know whether they're going to be able to run their programs or not. And then with this constant threat of shutdowns, they don't know when they're going to have to shut down their programs. Can they do what they're supposed to do? Can they not do it? Are they allowed to award a contract? It's extremely stressful and time-consuming and wasteful. Now, for everybody else looking at the government, I think the absolute conclusion that you have to draw from this is that this is no way to run a government. And so everybody outside the government is looking at this and saying, this is crazy. I manage a budget. Why can't the government pass an annual budget? And for everybody in state and local government and for everybody across the country who was downstream of this, who is a recipient of state or federal transfers, who is a recipient of grant money or funding, whether it's universities or nonprofits, they are looking at this and trying to figure out how we have descended to a point where something so basic doesn't seem to even be happening at all. And as Norm said, I mean, it's not as if we're even holding up the budget in this current shutdown. All that has been held up has been the latest, the fifth, you know, short-term extension of last year's budget, which was itself plagued by being full of short-term extensions from the previous year's budget. And everything that is happening in government that is innovative and exciting and new is happening outside of the federal government now. You know, it's all being pushed down. It's happening in cities. It's happening in states. You know, that's when the new, creative, exciting, innovative public policy is happening, because the federal government can barely even function now.
So, Norm Ornstein, this has not escaped the attention of other countries, particularly China, which says, you know, if there's all this uncertainty in the most powerful government in the world and so on, then it's a pretty lousy way, as we just heard, to run a government. What does this do for the United States as far as the rest of the world is concerned, not just in China, but in other countries? Britain, for example, as I understand it, if you can't pass the budget, the government goes out of existence, you have a new election.
Yeah, and that's other countries, particularly parliamentary ones, do this in a very different fashion. There's a government. This is the fundamental responsibility. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, the other cabinet members, the Prime Minister, put together a budget, and it is passed routinely with the votes of the majority. That's done in a parliamentary system. Ours is really unique. And it is dysfunctional. And as our President Donald Trump makes his way to Davos, it is very, very likely that the other world leaders who will congregate there will be talking amongst themselves about what an embarrassment he has been and the United States is becoming. I want to get back for a minute, Warren, to your cartoon again and address a couple of points. One of the reasons for the Budget and Impoundment Control Act, other than the disagreements with Nixon, was a belief in Congress that while this was their fundamental responsibility, they deferred much of it to the president. The president had what for a long time was called the Bureau of the Budget, and it became under Nixon the Office of Management and Budget. They had all the experts who could do the calculations and do the modeling and put the numbers together, and the president would submit a budget, and Congress was pretty much back on its heels. So one of the things they did was to create the Congressional Budget Office to give themselves a little bit more ammunition. But it's still the case that the president's priorities can matter here. We have a director of OMB, Mick Mulvaney, who was at the right edge of the right-wing Freedom Caucus, who proudly calls himself a right-wing nutcase, who proposed a budget that is absurd and self-defeating. It took money from the Coast Guard, for example, to help to fund the wall, which is self-defeating. It proposed eliminating the weather satellites that are part of the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration because they give us information about the weather, which would mean climate. But they're also the early warning system for hurricanes and other natural disasters, and they had originally proposed slashing the budget for the Federal Emergency Management Administration. So people would have less ability to prepare for a disastrous hurricane, and then no help at a later stage. Cutting money for the Centers for Disease Control right at a time when we hit the sort of 100-year cycle, which throughout human history has meant watch out for a disastrous pandemic. A set of things that have little to do with the actual problems that government faces. And all of those priorities, which were embraced by many in the House, have helped to create this dilemma where you can't get anything much done because the spending bills that fit a radical view of blowing up government clash with the realities of life and what most Americans experience, even if they don't realize that it's the government that's protecting them.
Linda Bilmes, I think a lot of what we're hearing is going to come as new to a lot of our listeners. How have the press handled all of this? It seems to me that all we read about is this blame game that we talked about earlier.
Well, I think that that's very true. I think that the mechanics of how the government is structured and the sort of dizzying number of programs and agencies that are currently threatened by various shifts in winds due to the current administration, it is so much to take in and to follow that I think it is frankly easier for many in the media to not go through all of the really difficult work of figuring out all of these programs and how they're affected, and to stay kind of in the froth, which is, you know, who's to blame for this and, you know, who's responsible for this at the moment. But one of the things that I have tried to do, and one of the things that I respect very much about Norm's work, is that, you know, underneath the froth here, I mean, there is a very, very significant change in what we're seeing the country being able to do. I mean, it's a real question about whether if we can't have a functioning budget process in which the country can determine what our priorities, both short-term and long-term, and can function together, and at least bipartisan some of the time, to resolve some of these issues, then it is very, very deeply troubling. And it doesn't really matter who's to blame for this shutdown or the next shutdown or the last shutdown. I mean, what matters is whether the government can be deliberative and can have some guidelines that most people agree to that will guide wisely how we allocate resources as a society.
Norm Ornstein, though, didn't this begin before Trump? I mean, isn't this something that has we talked earlier about what happened all the way back in 1974 and how this situation has sort of gotten worse and worse? And to what extent is the media responsible for that, covering politics as a circus, as we have done for so very long? And, you know, people always refer to the horse race, and that's sort of a polite way of describing it.
Yeah, and I do think I watched this the coverage this time, which had little to do with the fundamental underlying issues of these spending differences, and it was all about a kind of horse race: who's going to win and who's going to lose. That does go back a significant ways. What also goes back, Warren, is that Congress has had real difficulty coming up with these spending bills on a timetable that worked for a very, very long time. And some of it is that, you know, what government does. The appropriations reflect the priorities of the country. There are differences in those priorities, and we get into endgame negotiations where people try and get more leverage by letting it go right up until the last minute. Then you have the dramatic confrontations between Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton that led to the longer shutdowns over the Christmas period of 1995-96. We've had a lot of these before. They're almost never treated in the fundamental way by the press corps. It's just like elections. It's horse race politics.
And Linda Bilmes, back to you. I'm fascinated by one of the things you said, which is that the cities and states now are where new creative ideas are coming from. Does that suggest that we're going to see changes there long before we see changes in Washington? And maybe Washington will have something to learn.
Well, I think so. I mean, what I see right now is that the best and brightest of my students at the Harvard Kennedy School are are flowing into city and state governments, and they're very excited about the kind of innovation that's possible, I mean, both in terms of finance and thinking about public-private partnerships, thinking about social impact bonds, thinking about innovative ways to pay, innovative ways to use technology, innovative ways to use apps, innovative ways to use GIS mapping, you know, as well as innovative programmatic type of functions. And I think that among the younger generation in particular, you know, there's a sense that, well, you know, there are many programs where we spent a lot of money over a long period of time, and we may not be seeing the kind of results that we have hoped for. And that suggests that we ought to really rethink some of these programs, and we ought to at least try and pilot new approaches. And that thinking is so anathema to many large federal bureaucracies, which barely have time right now under the pressure of the budgeting chaos in Washington. They barely have time to do the things that they are legally mandated to do. You know, and they certainly don't have any backing within the Congress right now to really try creatively to think about new programs. And at the moment, they don't have a president who is leading that. But even when they did, it was very limited. It's hard to do these things at the national level, but there hasn't been the moment. So I see a lot of energy and innovation happening at regional and lower levels of government.
Norm, I think I heard Warren, you. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just a couple of points. One, on the good side, we are actually seeing a surge in younger people wanting to run for office. And we have an unprecedented number of impressive young candidates, including many women, jumping into races for Congress. They see an existential threat, I think, to our way of life. But the downside has two elements to it. One, which was reflected in a letter that Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis sent to the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee and to other members of Congress about how deeply destructive to our national defenses and the planning required having these continuing resolutions where you don't know from week to week what kind of money you're going to have. Budgeting by the year, doing appropriations where there's so much uncertainty, means that the fundamental planning you want to do, long-term planning, just gets blown up. The second is the demoralization that's occurring with civil servants and with our managers. And there was a little piece in the Washington Post quoting a 30-year federal employee named Eric King saying that he doesn't expect anything to change. He's feeling helpless. And he said the relentless instability is leading career employees to retire early and abandon agencies, leaving them increasingly thin on institutional knowledge. People are fed up, said King, an IT specialist with the Bureau of the Fiscal Service. I think it hurts the government overall because you are losing that knowledge and skill. We are reliant on that to provide quality service. The destructiveness of these actions, even if they reflect the deeper schisms in our politics, is going to hurt the next generations and the country's well-being very, very deeply.
And yet, Linda Bilmes, you've both suggested that the next generation does hold some hope.
Well, I think that the next generation, I mean, I'm a teacher, and so I have hundreds of students, and I'm extremely hopeful. I have 17 of my former students running for office this year, and some, you know, very exciting young people. I have former students, including Seth Moulton, and who are, you know, serving in Congress right now. I think that there's a lot of hope, and it makes me hopeful every day. However, I did want to say something on a less hopeful note about the military, about the military budget and how the military budget is financed. The current wars, the post 9/11 wars, have been financed entirely differently than any wars in U.S. history. In previous wars, in every previous war, wars were financed through some combination of higher taxes, of reductions to non-war spending, of fees, of dedicated war bonds, and monetary expansion, as well as some borrowing. But in this conflict, we have financed the wars entirely on the credit card war, and we have paid for them without any tax cuts. In fact, without, you know, any tax increases, of course, you know, taxes have been cut three times, and without any trade-offs to non to non-war military spending. So we now have this very, very strange creature. We have this special post 9/11 war budget, which gets funded entirely outside of the regular budget skirmishing, in addition to a 600-pound guerrilla defense budget. And there's been so much pressure on the 600-pound guerrilla defense budget that a lot of things that even should be in the regular budget go into the special war budget, even though they have nothing to do with the war. So we've created this, what I call it the ghost budget, you know, this special budget which gets minimal scrutiny. And we've created a situation in which most people in this country don't serve in the military, and we also don't pay anything for the current wars. And the consequence of this is that we become spectators. We become people who can just watch a war unfold, and we've created a budgetary situation in which it is much easier to prolong wars without even looking at what we're spending or whether we're getting good value for what we're spending. And right now, one of the things that has led to this whole chaos in Washington is that the president has proposed spending an additional $30 billion above the already record defense spending that we have spent, and Congress, trying to one-up him, has proposed spending even more than the president has proposed. And this, I think, the fact that this is happening and that nobody is looking at this seriously is one of the major threats to our fundamental ability to spend resources carefully and wisely.
And Norm Ornstein, this is political public relations, isn't it? When we are already spending more than whatever it is, the next 8 or 10 countries in the world on the military.
No doubt about it. There's a lot of public relations here, and the amount spent on defense is enormous. The priorities for defense spending have long been a problem, where the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines often do duplicative things, and we have weapons systems going back many decades that end up getting reauthorized and with money spent on them just because the contractors are across all 435 congressional districts. We could do a lot better job with more efficiency. But I also take Jim Mattis's point very seriously, and I think it applies to all government agencies. You have to do a lot of forward planning and a lot of projects that take place over many, many years to prepare for threats in the world. And if you can't do that, and if you are constantly spending a great deal of time simply preparing for what might be the next shutdown, you have government at its worst. You know, I often use the term these days, Warren, tachistocracy, a term that goes back to the 17th century that fell out of use, that comes from a Greek word, and it means government by the worst and least competent among us, and it means the worst kind of government. And that's what we're facing right now, and it's been bad for quite some time, but under Donald Trump, it is so much worse.
Linda Bilmes, we're going to see another shutdown?
I think if I were a betting person, I would definitely bet money on another shutdown.
How soon?
Whether it's in 3 weeks or not, I mean, it may be in another 3 weeks, it may be in another 4 months, but I think that the current situation does not provide a good structure in which budgeting can be done, and therefore we're going to keep seeing this kind of perpetual dysfunction, and we are going to keep seeing until we get a major budget reform that fixes the budget, we're going to keep seeing shutdowns.
Norm Ornstein?
I agree. And there are a couple of things to keep in mind here. One is we may see another confrontation, and will very likely, over the Dreamers and Mitch McConnell's quote-unquote promise to bring up a vote has little to do with what the House of Representatives might do or where Donald Trump or his co-presidents Stephen Miller and John Kelly might be on that issue. But these deeper divisions over spending are still there. And the Freedom Caucus in the House and a number of Senate Republicans are increasingly restive, because if you do a continuing resolution again and again and again, you're keeping last year's funding levels. And that means you don't implement the 15% across-the-board cuts, the so-called sequester that conservatives want, and in domestic spending they want even more. And in some ways, by preserving that status quo, it serves the interests of Democrats as well as Republicans who are not so eager to make those deep cuts. So the next shutdown may be precipitated as much, or the one that follows, by the more radical Republicans, if they keep doing continuing resolutions, as it would be by the Democrats.
Okay. As we indicated earlier, continuing resolutions have been the order of the day for a very long time. We haven't had a real budget for a very long time, passed and enacted and signed by the president. And thank you both for giving us so much information as to how this situation came about and what we can expect in the future. Great to have you. Linda Bilmes again, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Senior Lecturer in Public Policy at Harvard at the Kennedy School, and Norm Ornstein, a co-author, One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Desperate, the Disillusioned, and the Not Yet Deported. Thank you both.
Oh, thank you, Warren. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Warren. Thanks very much.
We've been talking about the news media's preoccupation with the blame game, and that's one reason we had to have this conversation about the history of government shutdowns as a political tactic. Well, there's a lot more to say about news coverage during this era of extraordinary change. Kyle Pope is editor-in-chief and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review. He goes so far as to say the political press corps has lost its steam. Kyle Pope, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do you mean, lost its steam?
I think everybody is exhausted. Honestly, I mean, it sounds like kind of a trite answer, but, if you look back at the last year of that we've just lived through, it's basically been one of the most extraordinary years. I think in the history of journalism, or certainly in the history of journalism and the presidency. We've been under attack from the president. We've been under incredible scrutiny. And we've been living in this sort of extraordinary news cycle where just day after day after day, we are just being hit with these sort of amazing stories. And if you look, so I sort of thought back through the whole last year and looked at the sort of progression of the coverage over the year. And I sort of broke it into two parts. If you look at the first half of the year, sort of from January to June, you have what I think is like may go down as one of the golden ages of American journalism, where you had newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post devoting incredible resources to what really was extraordinary coverage of everything having to do with this presidency, the Russia investigation, the turmoil in the cabinet, the what was going on with his legislative agenda, his immigration policy. And there was a lot of, aggressive, forward-leaning sort of coverage sort of along the lines of we're gonna sort of highlight what's important and that's what we're going to spend our time on. And then at some point over the summer, a lot of that work, I think, sort of lost steam. And you started to fall back into a lot of the coverage that we had been criticizing. There was a period between Election Day and Inauguration Day where there was a lot of reactive coverage where people were sort of obsessing about Trump's tweets. They're obsessing about the latest sort of outrageous thing that he had said. And I and others were admonishing the press, like, cool it with this sort of over-coverage of Trump's tweets. I mean, don't let him sort of set the agenda by saying the same thing over and over and over again. I mean, when he says...
You go so far as to say that the former reality TV star, and I'm reading this from your column, is assignment editor.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing. I understand how extraordinary it is, and I understand the kind of surreal situation we find ourselves in where you have the President of the United States saying really outrageous things on social media and how our instinct is to, like, just jump all over that. But it's repetitive, and he says the same thing over and over and over again. And And I think that the political press is sort of being led around by the nose at this point. That's one issue. The other issue is, you know, when you talk to people about what it's like to live in America right now, whatever side of the political divide you're on, I mean, you do get the impression that these are extraordinary times, and that this is a kind of like, almost, you know, an era that is going to live in our lifetimes is something that is, you know, deeply resonant in our souls. and I don't think that that a lot of this is being conveyed in the coverage.
So when we jump every morning at the latest tweet, and the president has a genius for coming up with a new tweet to distract attention away from everything else, what have we been missing?
Yeah, well, that's a question. I mean, I think these things are easy to cover. They're just sort of right there. And we've fallen into this pattern of kind of feeding people's biases. I mean, I have a friend, for instance, who is extremely upset by Trump. And spends all of her day like desperately searching out material and news that is going to feed her dislike. So she is on the hunt, right? She is on the hunt for news that is going to sort of reinforce her biases. And you see the same thing on the other side. So there, I think journalism has realized that there are clicks to be had here, and that there are stories to be read here, and that there's a kind of outrage factor here where everything we sort of, I mean, if I had a nickel every time, for instance, MSNBC says this is the thing that's going to bring down the Trump presidency, I would be on vacation, because it happens every single day. And I think we need to ratchet it down. We need to sort of stop letting him tell us what we should write. And we need to go back to that phase that we were in early last year where, you know, there's a lot of talk about, like, let's cover the agencies. Let's really get into the heart of government. Let's cover the Trump electorate in a way that hasn't been covered. Let's really delve into how he's changing the makeup of the federal bureaucracy. A lot of that has sort of faded away. And again, I go back to my original point. If you talk to these beat reporters, they're basically as exhausted as readers are.
So you want to see a new group of people take over?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's some great reporters here, but this is gets a little inside baseball about how these places were staffed. But a lot of the beat reporters you're seeing now they're the same reporters who covered the campaign, and most news organizations had a plan where for after Election Day, when Hillary became president, the staffs of the White House press corps were going to change, and new people were going to come in, and the old people were going to go out, and there was going to be a sort of refresh. What happened is that Hillary didn't win, Trump stayed in, the people who were covering the campaigns knew Trump better than anybody, and that most of the organizations said, we can't afford to change horses, and they've just stayed, and it really is amazing. I mean, if you look at almost every big national news organization, the people who are covering the White House now are the same people who were covering the campaign 2 years ago. And this cycle is just so unrelenting. It's almost unhuman.
And you end up covering it as if it's a campaign, because that's the context that you've been working in, I guess, for such a long time. I want to ask you about something that you talk about in your piece in the Columbia Journalism Review, which is how we retake the agenda. And you're suggesting that we need to be aggressive rather than defensive. When you started talking that way, what do you say to people who say, wait a minute, your job is to tell the American people what the President of the United States is saying and doing. It's not to retake the agenda.
Yeah, I think it's. I think that that's usually the case, that we, you know, our job is just to say what the president says, unless we have a president who's sort of on social media like throughout the day and sort of repeating the same thing over and over again. You know, I'm less focused on sort of, you know, how the details of what we cover than in sort of recognizing the fact that I think the form as it's being practiced now isn't working. I don't, and again, I think you would hear the same thing if you talk to people on the right. I don't think the coverage of the White House now is conveying the sort of scale and sweep of what's happening in America, both on the right and on the left. And that is something that we fundamentally need to look at.
Well, don't you need to look away from the White House then? That's not really where you're going to find it, is it?
You have to look away from the West Wing.
So where do you look? And does this mean that we should, you know, we've said so often that, you know, there's flyover country or the heartland, whatever it's called, which infuriates the people who live between the coasts. But is that where we should be going? Is there a sort of a geographical aspect to this?
I think, I mean, you remember right after the election when a lot of news organizations were like, oh, my God, we missed this. We missed these voters. We're going to recommit. We're going to. And, you know, largely not much has happened. There was a whole, there was a flurry of stories initially, and then it has sort of faded away. And we're still back. We're almost sort of back to where we started, where, in fact, it's almost like news organizations are more dug in and entrenched than they were before in their sort of commitment to covering these parts of the country. And I think that's just part of it, though. I mean, I think that, you know, what we saw around Charlottesville last year is that news organizations also are like overwhelmingly white, and it's making it very difficult for them to cover communities of color. They tend to be dominated by men, and it's made it very difficult for them to cover the Me Too movement. So there's a lot of like fundamental work that needs to go on in terms of remaking how journalism thinks about itself.
Are there other particular stories that you have in mind when you say that, you know, we had a golden age at one point up until, I don't know, 6 months ago or something like that, and that now we've turned away? And to what extent does this turning away have to do with the need to for clicks and the requirement by editors that you show up with an audience?
Yeah, there's no doubt that Trump has been good for business in journalism. I mean, if you look at almost any news organization and their most viewed or most clicked on stories, it tend to be Trump stories. There's been a, and this to me is like, it has forced a sort of fundamental shift. I mean, there's been a surge of people willing to pay for quality journalism, which has been great. And we call it the Trump bump, where you have subscriptions at a lot of these big national organizations are going up. But if you think through what that means that your business model now is based on tailoring your coverage to an audience that's passionate enough about what you're doing that they're willing to pay money for. The model used to be that you're as broad based as you can be because you want to cast out a really wide net and bring in a ton of people so you could sell advertising against that. The advertising model is now essentially broken, and it's all about subscriptions. So it really is sort of rewarding places to become more narrow in their coverage and more partisan and more sort of and again, we get back to this sort of outrage factor, I think, is clicking it more, and it's being fed by these business model changes.
Seems to me that we're sort of going in the wrong direction, too. I was in television news locally here in Los Angeles for a long time, and it used to be when I started out, I was an investigative reporter. They would come to me and they'd say, what have you got that we can use to advertise in order to appeal to listeners or viewers at the time when the rates for advertising were being decided? And at the end of my career, and one of the reasons I left, was that they were coming to me and saying, well, what our focus groups tell us the listener wants to know is, or the viewer wants to know, is blah, blah, blah. And it seems to me that's sort of in the reverse order. I mean, what you want from the news is something you don't know yet.
Yeah. There was a really interesting case recently where the New York Times on their editorial page, this is last week, it was right around the one-year anniversary of Trump's inauguration, devoted their entire editorial page to letters from Trump supporters.
Yeah.
And it's exactly what you just said. It was like, let's hear from these people. They were pilloried by their own subscribers. Like, why are you giving us these people? This is not who we want to read. These people have no place in our newspaper. We don't want to hear from them. The backlash was significant, and that's sort of where we are now.
So what do we do?
You know, I mean, I go back to this idea of, it's interesting. I was meeting with a group. This is a totally random thing, but I was meeting with a group in New York recently. It was mainly artists, and they were all saying, "We don't know how we should respond to Trump. There seems to be the need for a response in the artistic community. I'm not talking about like protests. I'm talking about like people's actual artwork reflecting the state of the world. And they were saying, we don't know how to express this. It's not coming to us yet. And it just struck me that we're having the same conversation in journalism. I do think now that we've been at this long enough where, we basically have a situation where we will report something, they will go to the White House, and either the White House spokesman or the president or one of the president's people will essentially lie in response and deny this ever happened, right? And then that is dutifully reported, and then we're sort of left back to where we started. I mean, I saw this week that Mike Pence is sort of saying that this payment that was reported by Trump to this porn star was not true, which is not true. we could spend the next 30 minutes on the phone going through sort of case after case after case where that's happened. So I think we need to sort of rethink sort of how we report and sort of lay out these stories. And how, whether is it even appropriate to let the White House sort of control a news cycle by denying things that are sort of demonstrably true? I don't think so.
Very quickly, in terms of those things that we're missing, what about the Women's March this past weekend? And how well was that covered compared to the blame game in Washington?
Yeah, I think it depends on where you live. I live in New York, and it received a fair amount of coverage here. But I think nationally it wasn't, and I think there was a kind of a rote quality to it. Like, oh yeah, people are in the streets, they're carrying funny signs, and it's almost become a kind of internet meme where you have like a picture of a kid with a sign with the kind of clever saying. Mm. And it doesn't really get to this. I mean, but if you pause for 10 seconds and think about this, I mean, this is an extraordinary moment where you have tens of thousands of people going out on the street and protesting. This just doesn't happen every day in this country. So I think it's still a moment to be sort of amazed. But again, I mean, I frankly think this goes once again back to this idea of like the narratives are established, we're kind of sick of them, and we're going to sort of go through the motions. And you hear this a lot. You hear this, and again, from both sides, but in this case, you hear it a lot from progressive activists who are like, are you kidding? That this march was a major thing, and people covered it as if it was like yet another kind of, yet another local story in a local market.
Okay, well, let's hope that publishers, editors, and reporters are listening to what you're saying or beginning to realize themselves what you have said. I think it's really important. I happen to agree with it completely. And thanks a lot for being with us, Kyle Pope.
Thanks for having me.
Editor-in-Chief of the Columbia Journalism Review, also a publisher. Great to have you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
The subjects that the president has lied about are all too familiar, but just to remind you, here are a few. First of all, his questioning about President Obama's birthplace.
Why doesn't he show his birth certificate?
And I have my own theory on Obama.
It's one of the greatest scams in the history of politics.
And there was Ted Cruz's father connected to Lee Harvey Oswald.
His father was with Lee Harvey Oswald. What was he doing with Lee Harvey Oswald?
He fostered the idea that childhood vaccinations cause autism.
The child, a beautiful child, went to have the vaccine and came back and a week later got a tremendous fever, got very, very sick, now is autistic.
And there was this about the late Justice Antonin Scalia being murdered.
It's a horrible topic, but they say they found a pillow on his face, which is a pretty unusual place to find a pillow.
And remember, he said again and again that Muslims had cheered after 9/11?
And I watched in Jersey City, New Jersey, where thousands and thousands of people were cheering.
He later refuted his own apology and said that the Access Hollywood tape wasn't even real.
I said it. I was wrong. and I apologize.
Of course, we know he claimed millions of voters illegally cast their ballots in the 2016 election. President Trump has, according to the Washington Post, recorded more than 2,000 lies in his first year in office. That must be some kind of record for any politician. This To The Point podcast was produced by Andrea Brody and Evan Schwartz. Our engineer's Joel Stein. To The Point is available at Apple Podcasts, other podcast forums, and at kcrw.com/To The Point. Let us know what you think. I'm Orvin Olney. Thanks for listening.